Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And now, as usual, we turn to the biz page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. There are four or five articles here. Under the heading of Looking Ahead comes the article, Changing the Office. Be sure to communicate effectively. So what will offices look like in the years ahead? Digital signs rather than modern art hanging on the walls? Different temperature controls for individual workstations? Sensors that can tell when a certain person is entering the room? And new technology launching their workspace? That emerging technology was part of a conversation CoreNet held on August the 9th at Linwood Brewing Concern. As commercial real estate professionals from around the market munched on meatballs, sipped IPAs, and weighed what clients will want in the years to come. Zeister Consulting, which has offices in New York, Boston, and Washington, D.C., visited the Triangle to lead the discussions. President David Khalif, who is based out of New York, tells Biz the advent of the mobile workforce will only accelerate change, with offices becoming more collaborative and personalized. The days of the fixed desk in the office are gone, he says, adding, if you're not a senior member of the staff of company, you're not likely getting your own office. And under the heading of golf dispute comes the article, Case Closed, Peggy Kirk Bell's son sells his shares. A nasty lawsuit involving the son of one of the state's top golf families has been resolved. Kirk Bell, the youngest of three children of Peggy Kirk Bell and her husband Warren, had asked the courts to either dissolve Pine Needles Country Club Incorporated in Southern Pines or turn it over to neutral management. The company runs Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club and has other assets, including a stake in Mid Pines Inn and Golf Club. The lawsuit includes details about the operation, claiming Pine Needles has gross annual income of about $5.5 million. The Bells acquired Pine Needles in 1953. Warren Bell died in 1984 and Peggy Kirk Bell in 2016. Kirk Bell claimed he and his children were shut out of the operation even though he owned about 555 shares of Class A common stock out of 1,994 shares and about 646 shares of Class B stock out of 1,940. According to court documents, the two sides reached a global resolution of their dispute on July 19. And under the heading of Energize comes the article, Duke Students Stretch a Gallon of Gas. A new car designed by students at Duke University could propel you between the Raleigh and Durham downtowns 583 times on the equivalent of 1 gallon of gas. That's according to a record-breaking run by the Duke Electric Vehicles team at the Pratt School of Engineering that took place in July and set the new Guinness World Record mark for most fuel-efficient vehicle on the globe. At a track in Benson, the hydrogen fuel cell vehicle traveled more than 8.5 miles on less than 1 gram of pure hydrogen, a consumption rate that equates to 14,753 miles per gallon, according to Duke. Our vehicle is capable of driving to any point on the globe using the energy in 1 gallon of gas, outgoing DEV president and electrical engineering graduate Patrick Grady said. The vehicle stands at about knee height and looks like a futuristic space coffin. And under the heading of Sticking to Dollars comes the article, Cryptocurrency for Campaigns? Not yet, North Carolina says. The state of North Carolina isn't ready to let politicians accept digital currency, at least not yet. And that's caused some grumbling among its advocates. Kim Westbrook-Strock, executive director of the State Board of Elections, said the state wasn't ready for the move after a Republican candidate requested formal guidance. Strock cited concerns about monetary limits, which are in dollars in finance laws, and said contributions cannot be made anonymously. She also pointed to concern about SBE's ability to regulate contributions as part of their reasoning. In other words, whoa. But Whitney Christensen, a government relations attorney at Raleigh's Ward & Smith, says Bitcoin is just the next frontier. And Ward & Smith's Jim Verdonik says many concerns about digital currency are unfounded. There's this misnomer that Bitcoin is untraceable, Vernonik says. It just takes a little more work to track it, and it's very traceable in large quantities. And under the heading of Cool Effort comes the article, Students Exposed to STEM Thanks to Effort, by Cree. Cree's latest project is a water-propelled rocket, sort of. The Durham semiconductor manufacturer hosted a STEM day on August the 9th, where employees worked to inspire students by showing them how their work in STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, and the triangle, contributes to technological advancements. And the day included a bottle rocket challenge where students test flew rockets, worked with robots, and even used programming to light LEDs based on motion. STEM Day 2018 was presented in partnership with the North Carolina Science Olympiad and STEM in the Park. Cree recently reported $1.5 billion in revenue for its latest fiscal year. And finally, on the biz page comes the article, Hey, Tourists, Wake County Wants You in Droves by 2028. An in-depth report raises a new bar for Wake County when it comes to tourism and also outlines some challenges ahead. The Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau hired Jones Lang LaSalle to lead a 13-month review of the county's resources and potential, with a goal of hiking visitation from 16.45 million to 21.7 million by 2028. That's a whopping jump for a county with a state capital, museums and sports, but lacking the appeal of North Carolina's beaches and mountains. The report is an effort to help capitalize on more visitor spending, which was estimated at $2.5 billion in direct spending for the year 2017. The report, revealed August the 16th, focuses on three categories, meetings, sports, and leisure travel. It notes that Wake has relatively low base of hotels with roughly 17,000 rooms and calls for an expanded Raleigh Convention Center with an adjacent hotel with at least 400 rooms. The expansion could spill over into the space now occupied by Red Hat Amphitheater, with a similar facility becoming part of Dorothea Dix Park. With Dorothea Dix Park's planning process now underway, there's potential for a similar size and scale venue to be an anchor site within that park, the report says. The report also sees opportunities for Wake County when it comes to sports, especially building venues for youth sports and with the base of museums. The museums give the market a chance to evolve as a Smithsonian of the South if the museums could work more collaboratively and produce more of the blockbuster events that bring in tourists. But the report also notes interesting concerns about Dix Park. The topic of Dix Park produced an undercurrent of skepticism, largely around the level of funding needed for successful development of the park. Additionally, the stakeholders felt the park concepts would become watered down to help lower development costs, the report states. Now we turn to this week's On Technology page from the Triangle Journal. And under the heading of Road Help comes NC fronts $4.5 million for Amazon in Garner. In 2019, a massive 1,500-job Amazon Fulfillment Center will open along Garner's Jones Sausage Road at what used to be ConAgra's Slim Jim plant. It's the largest economic development win in town history, officials have said. So the town of Garner is teaming up with the state to mitigate the traffic impact, a move that means millions of dollars for the project's Texas-based developer, Hillwood. The North Carolina Department of Transportation is fronting the firm $4.5 million toward road improvements. Improvements will run from I-40 to East Garner Road on Jones Sausage, explains Joey Hopkins, division engineer for the NC DOT. For the majority of that, we're talking about widening Jones Sausage to a four-lane divided highway, he says. That includes new turn lanes and traffic signals and a wider ramp onto I-40. The project, coupled with NC DOT's effort to widen I-40, adding additional lanes in each direction from the Beltline to NC-42, will definitely help alleviate a lot of the existing traffic out there, Hopkins predicts. And for the article, California firm with triangle ties picks Raleigh for its East Coast headquarters. Fueled by a Walmart contract and a recent $40 million funder, Oakland, California-based Even is expanding to Raleigh, picking the city over Atlanta and Tampa for its new East Coast headquarters. The move has even, co-founded by longtime Raleigh resident Quentin Farmer, following the money east after Durham-based Bull City Venture Partners participated in its latest fundraiser alongside other investors. Farmer, an NC State University graduate, already had Raleigh in his sights when he and an old acquaintance, BCVP co-founder Jason Kaplan, had breakfast in December. Farmer happened to mention that they were looking at expanding, a statement Kaplan says he jumped on. So we talked about the momentum happening in the Raleigh-Durham area, Kaplan says. Farmer found it enticing. Even partners with Fortune 500 companies, offering apps that integrate with attendance, payroll, and banking systems to help enterprise employees understand their financial health. And it was in the midst of landing its biggest client yet, Walmart. The firm needed an East Coast headquarters for the time zone, but the specifics of the location were always going to center around talent, he says. We started thinking about finance and engineering teams, Farmer recalls, noting that the Triangle was a clear leading option from the beginning when the universities came into the conversation. Farmer says the chat with Kaplan solidified the pick, but it didn't stop there. The more they talked about the business model, the more Kaplan wanted to invest. By the end of the year, Even expects to have 20 people working in Raleigh. And under the heading of Inside the Deal comes the article, Xylem Scrapped Plans for Charlotte and Pledged Growth for Durham. In June, nearly 2 years after buying Raleigh smart metering firm Census, New York clean tech Xylem announced plans to expand the operation, bringing 301 jobs to Durham by 2022. But the move, announced in exchange for state incentives worth more than $3.5 million, would come after an even larger plan had been scrapped for the state, according to nearly 800 pages of just-released public records. Plans approved in March call for 450 jobs in both Durham and Mecklenburg counties in exchange for a package worth nearly $6 million. Memos describe how, on top of growth for Census in Durham, Xylem planned to relocate subsidiary Xylem Water Solutions to a new location in Charlotte, which will house their sales teams and serve as a regional headquarters. A press release had even been drafted to announce the news, but it was all put on hold when the company abruptly took Mecklenburg County out of the mix. In an email on May the 8th, Nate Groover, business recruitment manager for the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, told colleagues that while Xylem is committed to job retention and job growth in Charlotte, it did not want to formally commit to the 149 jobs as originally planned. And finally, from the technology page, under the heading of More Jobs, comes the article, Firm Celebrates Role in Cave Rescue and Preps for Growth in Raleigh. As Analog Devices prepares to more than double its local headcount, growing from 55 to an eventual 120 after it moves into the Dillon in downtown Raleigh, executives have learned their technology was used in the rescue of a dozen soccer players and their coach in Thailand. It's very rewarding, says Tony Montalvo, a fellow at the Massachusetts company. The chip didn't swim in the cave and get the kids out, but it did play a significant role. That role surrounded communication, a pain point solved by a radio enabled with an AD9364 Agile transceiver developed at Raleigh's Centennial Campus. An ordinary radio signal can't cut through 2 miles of cavern, she says. Rescue radios usually work one of two ways, where one device talks to another, or where multiple radios work through a central device. Those options couldn't penetrate the rock and water, he says. Israeli firm MaxTech Network, which uses Analog Devices chips, deployed a network where one radio would talk to another, which talked to another, and on down the line until communications reached outside the caverns. Now we move to the real estate page from this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Downtown Raleigh comes the article, The Dillon's Success Could Boost the Warehouse District. Just 2 months after offices opened at the Dillon Tower in downtown Raleigh, there's almost no office space left to rent. That's after Bermuda-based Arch Capital Services inked a 104,000-square-foot lease at the 18-story building, taking the recently opened structure from just over 50% occupied to almost completely full. The firm, which bypassed Atlanta for Raleigh, will move into four stories of the building, joining a number of other office tenants that includes co-working company spaces. John Kane, CEO of Kane Realty, says when his company began work on the tower in 2016, he anticipated office leasing would wrap up 6 to 8 months after completion. That puts the Dillon ahead of schedule. Just over 8,000 square feet of available space remains, out of a total of 221,300 square feet. The Dillon rents for $35 per square foot, according to Triangle Business Journal's most recent space edition. Kane believes the success shows the growing pull the warehouse district is exerting on companies looking to attract younger workers. It's a little more techy, it's a little more edgy, he says. The leasing activity also underscores what Kane views as a fundamental truth of the Raleigh office market. You have to build before tenants will sign leases. You've really got to get the building going before you get through much leasing, he says. The success of the Dillon could bode well for other office buildings under construction in downtown Raleigh. It also could mean more companies look to the warehouse district in particular. This is certainly a sign that that district has a lot of appeal for office users, says Bill King, Senior Vice President of Economic Development and Planning at the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. The Dillon is contributing to this street-level revitalization as well. Along the street front will be Weaver Street Market, Urban Outfitters, Oku Sushi, Oak Steakhouse, Bishop's Cuts and Color, Heirloom Brew Shop, and Barcelona Wine Bar. Arch Capital was also drawn to Raleigh in part by tax breaks, finalized by the state in July, that could result in reimbursements worth up to $5.1 million over 12 years, in exchange for bringing 365 jobs to the region. The company could reap big savings by locating in North Carolina, where labor and real estate costs are lower than the Northeast. The company is consolidating employees from offices in New York and New Jersey, creating a hub in Raleigh, focusing on insurance, reinsurance, and corporate functions. Average salaries will exceed $109,000. Now, in other news from the real estate page, under the heading of Near NCSU, comes the article, Chicago Developer Plans Hillsborough Street Apartments. Redevelopment proposals continue to pop up along Hillsborough Street, the latest being a 246,000-square-foot project. A developer has submitted plans to the city for a three-story apartment building complex that would span the width of the block, an area currently home to several aging and low-slung buildings, including the East Village Grill and Bar. The project will be built on property between Dixie Trail and Daisy Street, across from the Stanhope Student Apartments. CA Ventures of Chicago is pitching the project for 9 parcels, totaling just under 2.5 acres. The lots are owned by separate entities, many of them with businesses located on site. Many of the buildings are decades old, such as the East Village Grill and Bar space that was originally built in 1969. Documents filed with the city show development spanning the entire property, except for a space cut out of the building for a pool. The project would have 142 units, with 59 of those being 4-bedroom units. And under the heading of auction comes the article, Chapel Hill Mansion sells for less than half the asking price. You may have missed a bargain here. The saltwater swimming pool and a 9,000-square-foot interior of a Cisco executive's Chapel Hill mansion weren't enough to convince bidders to pay close to the home's initial listing price at an auction last month. When the gavel fell, the highest bid for the ornate home of Ed and Barbara Paradise was $1.456 million. Before the auction, the home was listed on the market for $3.15 million. Good grief, says Gilliam Cottrell of Hodge & Cottrell Sotheby's International Realty. That's certainly a bargain for whoever bought it. Cottrell had previously worked with the couple to sell the home and says the low sales price could be due to a small pool of buyers. Home auctions are somewhat rare in the Triangle and more commonly take place in mountain resort or beach communities, agents say. Those working in the luxury market have also said older high-end homes have had trouble selling compared to new luxury homes. A lot of buyers looking in this price range sometimes choose to build a new home if they have the time to do that, says Molly Owen, also of Hodge & Cottrell Sotheby's International Realty. And finally, on the real estate page, under the heading of New Plans, comes the article, Developer Plans Apartments Near Crabtree Valley Mall. A Raleigh developer focused on several Inside the Beltline projects in Raleigh is at it again. Grub Ventures hasn't broken ground just yet on its new Glenwood Avenue office building, but has already submitted plans to the city for a neighboring project, this one a 273-unit apartment complex. The documents show a five-story building on a narrow parcel along National Drive, a property that's currently home to two office buildings that date to the 1970s. The existing buildings total just over 53,000 square feet, while the new apartment complex will surpass 343,000 square feet. The firm doesn't have a timetable for development yet, a process that's more complex because of the existing buildings and tenants, says Anthony Smithson, Grub Ventures senior project manager. He says the goal of the new project is to draw more residents to an area traditionally dominated by office buildings. Retail space is part of both the existing and proposed apartment buildings. Now it's time to take a look at business trends page for this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of pharmaceuticals comes the article, Bausch Health expects Raleigh subsidiary to double revenue in 5 years. Bausch Health, formerly known as Valiant Pharmaceuticals International, has released expectations for its Raleigh-based division and expects OrthoDermatologics to double revenue by 2022. The pharmaceutical company expects the growth to be primarily driven by the release of 7 new products. OrthoDermatologics will release 5 of the 7 products later this year. 3 of its acne products are currently undergoing Phase 3 trials, while its Altreno and Rehali products have been given Prescription Drug User Fee Act dates. Bausch's ambitious guidance comes at a time when Ortho's top-line numbers are struggling to keep up with the Bausch's overall growth. The Raleigh company reported $110 million in revenue for the second quarter. That's down 18% from the $134 million reported during the same period last year. This loss created a 17% decrease in organic growth, according to the company. Celique, one of the 2 products under the OrthoDermatologics division, reported $4 million in U.S. sales for the fiscal period, and its TRX weekly prescriptions nearly tripled compared to last quarter. Ortho's Retin-A micro products also saw more than 50% year-over-year growth. OrthoDermatologics accounts for 7% of Bausch Health's total revenue. Because of the losses during the earnings call, Bausch officials noted the company is planning on stabilizing the ortho segment. Bausch Health's annual goodwill impairment test found a $243 million impairment in the subsidiary value. This valuation hit was due to changes in the dermatology sector, increased pressure from third-party payers, additional risk to the exclusivity of certain products, and a longer-than-expected launch cycle for new products. This caused OrthoDermatologics' book value to exceed its fair value. Bausch Health ran another impairment test for the second quarter fiscal 2018 because of these adverse indicators and found that Ortho's fair value now exceeds the book value by 5%. Overall, Bausch Health reported revenue of $2.1 billion for the quarter. Diluted earnings were reported to be at a loss of $2.49 a share, compared to a loss of 11 cents per share reported in the same quarter last year. Bausch reported adjusted income of 93 cents per share, surpassing analyst estimates of 81 cents per share. Valiant Pharmaceuticals acquired Salix Pharmaceuticals, now rebranded as OrthoDermatologics, for roughly $11 billion in 2015. Also from the heading of Business Trends comes Durham chosen for Financial Empowerment Fund. Durham has been chosen as one of 10 cities to receive a $20,000 planning grant and months of technical assistance to identify and implement plans to financially empower low-income residents. The grants provided by the Cities for Financial Empowerment Fund's City Start Initiative with assistance from J.P. Morgan Chase. The purpose is to offer mayors and their administrations ways to pinpoint goals for financial improvement among residents and create sustainable programs to do so. For all of our residents to fully participate in Durham's economy, it's essential that they have access to adequate banking services, reputable financial education, and opportunities to build assets and savings, Mayor Steve Shule said. The City Start Initiative uses its network of local government leaders in more than 60 cities to provide insights about the impact of financial instability on families and communities. Durham's Financial Inclusion Initiative will be led by Andre Pettigrew, Director of the City's Office of Economic and Workforce Development. Pettigrew will work with the CFE Fund to plan and host a finance boot camp for local constituents. Durham then will develop and implement a plan to create a more financially secure community. Across the nation, more and more city leaders are embracing high-quality financial empowerment programs to improve the financial stability of their residents and communities, said Jonathan Mintz, President and CEO of the Cities for Financial Empowerment Fund. Currently, 16.8% of Durham residents live in poverty, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Now we come to this week's cover story, which is entitled, Where Every Penny is Earned. Joseph Riddle owns a piece of property that's a perfect vantage point in Chapel Hill, a place where you can watch students grab coffee between classes or, after major basketball wins, rush Franklin Street. Riddle purchased the property for about $700,000 in the early 1990s. Today, the assessed valuation for Riddle's building and land is $9,744,600, and he's not done pouring money into the iconic College Street. Chapel Hill prides itself on being different, Riddle says. When you want to do something in Chapel Hill, you better find out they want it or need it. While businesses tend to come and go quickly, ownership of Franklin Street property is far less volatile. Behind its blue and white details are 22 people who control more than 60% of Franklin Street properties. On a normal day, Franklin Street's the picture of a classic college town. Students on their phones with book bags slung over their shoulders, visitors buying Tar Heel paraphernalia at one of the many t-shirt shops, and even Carolina blue fire trucks rolling down the street. When Riddle, who lives in Fayetteville, bought the building at the corner of Franklin and Columbia Street, it housed the one-screen Carolina Theater. He's seen tenants come and go since then. It's now home to the popular Top of the Hill restaurant, as well as a Walgreens and new Italian eatery, Midi C. When national onlookers and weekend visitors can't see, are the millions of dollars that have carved out a unique and difficult business scene. With the high visibility of Franklin Street comes high rents, which can be a challenge for the small shops that line it. Everybody doesn't understand why people can't make it on Franklin Street, says John Woodard, the retired owner of Sutton's Drugstore, which dates to 1923. It makes no sense to stay here. Everybody thinks all of us are just taking it home in a wheelbarrow, but it's the owners of the building. The owners face their challenges as well. One who has thrived is Robert Poitras, who was wise enough to buy the property for his Carolina brewery. He later sold the land to his partner. A lot of big players have failed here, Poitras says. Chapel Hill doesn't like chains. Look at the chains that haven't made it here. Old Chicago, Carolina Ale House. Heck, Michael Jordan's restaurant didn't even make it here. So who exactly owns the properties along Franklin Street, the storied road named for Ben Franklin that dates to the early years of the university? Triangle Business Journal analyzed property records and other data to discover the owners of Franklin Street property between Robertson Street to the east and Graham Street to the west. This area encompasses the main business scene of downtown Chapel Hill. Poitras is one of the few property owners on Franklin Street who actually runs the business housed in his property. I've been doing it all along since February 9, 1995, he says. In fact, he adds, he wrote the business plan his senior year at UNC. Most Franklin Street property owners are like Fayetteville's Riddle and rent out their spaces. Many live elsewhere in the state and even in the country. The owners of Franklin Street property are a similar bunch, often owning property for many years and often having a local connection to the area. Rarely do owners own more than one lot. More than a few owners have purchased property since attending the university. Often the tether that people create with Franklin Street doesn't go away. Poitras's 20-year stint is an anomaly for a street that sees a very steady turnover rate, according to Chapel Hill Mayor Pam Heminger. This last year alone has seen dozens of closings, such as Topper's Pizza, R&R Grill, Artisan Pizza Kitchen, Noodles & Company, McAllister's Deli, and others. Even Spanky's, a Chapel Hill mainstay since 1977, closed this spring. Though Spanky's is not changing hands, its owners hope that rebranding as Southern food restaurant Lula's will give business a fresh boost. Competition and high rents are usually a combination that leads to business failure on the street. Poitras says buying the Carolina Brewery building in the beginning was the smartest thing we ever did. Riddle hasn't been as lucky with tenants. When he first purchased the Carolina Theater building, it was a one-screen theater run by a Canadian company. Then it was a record shop, followed by a Gap, and then finally construction began on Top of the Hill restaurant. Riddle has since purchased three other buildings on the historic street. One houses wrap shop Bieskies, and the other two are vacant. To Riddle, what really hurt Franklin Street was the opening of the streets at South Point in Durham in 2002. After that, he says, it was hard to get standard retail because there was a mall so close. They took the Gap and Sephora from Franklin Street. Since then, Riddle says businesses need a truly unique combination of factors to make it. Carolina Ale House, a Raleigh-based chain that has seen explosive growth in recent years, had no luck in Chapel Hill either. It was housed in and still pays rent on one of Riddle's properties, where it only lasted a year and a half. A car dealership had the spot before the Ale House, meaning there was a tremendous amount of money spent on renovations. I don't know what we saved other than the shell, he says. There's a lot of places you can watch a game and get a hamburger, and the Ale House wasn't better than any of them, he says. Todd Zapolsky, a partner of Westside Limited Partners, which owns the 306 West Franklin Street complex that houses six different businesses, also says South Point was a significant hit to Chapel Hill proper. Westside Limited Partners has owned the 306 West Franklin Street property since 1988. According to records. Another challenge, Chapel Hill's strict building policies. Before 2000, there was a hard policy that buildings couldn't be more than two stories, according to Riddle. We had to fight to get our 2.5 stories, says Riddle, referring to Top of the Hill, which has a balcony that counts for another half story. Sapolsky, who lives in California, says he felt the pains of the building policy indirectly, since Westside Limited Partners building always has been one story. We really needed the policy to change so that more offices and things could be built to increase the number of people spending money on Franklin Street, he says. Since 2000, though, Chapel Hill has been steadily growing upward, but not just to give builders more leeway. They finally figured out the only way they could raise tax dollars was they could overtax what little they had, or they could build up, Riddle says. They want to grow their tax base. Chapel Hill has a total sales tax rate of 7.5%, compared to Raleigh and Charlotte's 7.25%, or Wilmington's 7%. Woodard, the retired owner of Sutton's, also says the fact that many of the buildings are aging adds to the challenges owners face. These new people coming in and buying the buildings, they've got to bring them up to code and redo them, he says. When the Rathskeller shut down in 2007, they went in and redid the lower level down there to bring it up to code for another restaurant to go in. But what it was going to take to open another restaurant there, it wasn't even feasible. The 5,500-square-foot basement property where the iconic Rathskeller restaurant used to live is still vacant and listed to lease for $6,875 per month. Whether pouring money into Franklin Street is a good investment, says Riddle, would depend on each deal, building, or parcel, or land. Poitras adds, a lot of people look at the demographics of Chapel Hill, the 1, 3, and 5 mile demographics, and say, wow, that many people and that many students? No brainer. Riddle has noticed that while traditional restaurants and retail have struggled, residential units and hotels have been successful in spite of the fact that land prices have skyrocketed. Though Zapolsky thinks his investment has been historically good, he does confirm that people have tried and failed, and tenants have had to be replaced. A Franklin Street investment has never been easy, he says. Despite the dramatic growth in outside dollars flowing into the Triangle, Franklin Street has not seen the colossal investments coming to the downtowns in Raleigh and Durham. Roger Perry of Chapel Hill's East-West Partners thinks Franklin Street is not attractive to national investors, though local and regional developers would love to be doing more if they could. I don't think it's big enough or has enough going on to get a national investor or a developer. I don't think there's enough there for that, he says. Even if they are, Perry says, Franklin Street presents challenges for major investment. The ownership is so fragmented that getting enough property to really do something is really difficult, he says. There hasn't been much property transferring. There's a lot of absentee and passive owners. While downtown Chapel Hill has eluded East-West Partners so far, Perry believes change is coming along Franklin Street. I'm sure it'll change hands over time, he says. The buildings are in desperate need for renovation, and I don't think the owners are up to fixing that. The rest of Chapel Hill is much healthier. One of the biggest owners of Franklin Street property is UNC Chapel Hill. It owns 12 properties along the street, whose tenants include retail, restaurants, private student housing, and office space locations. The university acquired these properties through a mix of endowment money, direct university purchases, and the use of Chapel Hill Foundation Real Estate Holdings Incorporated. The Real Estate Foundation is a private nonprofit formed to develop and manage real estate projects for the university, according to Stephanie Barrier, Communications Manager for Facility Services and Real Estate at UNC. The real estate holdings are a positive for the school, which gets to control its neighborhood and benefit from rents, but does have an impact on the town. Chapel Hill gets no taxes from the university, so the university owns most of the good property, and the town gets no taxes from it. Normally, a town derives a lot of tax dollars off of industry, but the only industry in Chapel Hill is the university, Riddle says. Barrier confirms that the university pays no local tax on at least five of its Franklin Street properties, including those housing retail and restaurant space. However, properties bought through Chapel Hill Foundation Real Estate Foundation are subject to local tax and regulation. Triangle Business Journal also examined the leases the university has with its retail tenants and found their charges to be on par with the rest of Franklin Street. Sugarland, the cupcake shop, has a 1,420-square-foot property on the east end of Franklin Street. Beginning August 1st, their rent rose to a monthly cost of $3,052.46, an increase of 2% from last year's rent. Carolina Coffee Shop has 2,854 square feet and pays $5,000 in rent per month. That will increase to $6,000 in 2020. Bank of America pays the university $2,868.50 per month for an ATM on the same block. According to the university's fiscal 2017 investment report, 6.7% of UNC's portfolio was comprised of real estate last year. The institution's total portfolio in 2017 had a market value of $5.4 billion. This means university-owned real estate in 2017 clocked in at a market value of about $362 million. Franklin Street properties on the West End tend to cost more than their East Side counterparts, thanks to a new development in the 140 Franklin complex and the Carolina Square property, which have driven traffic to that end of the street. On the East End, the $6,875 price tag for the Rathskiller property is more common. Another 1,500-square-foot property nearby is listed for $3,500 a month. By comparison, a 3,600-square-foot West End retail property was recently listed to lease for $8,400 per month. A smaller 2,856-square-foot property just a few doors down was recently listed for $9,282 per month. Woodard, the owner of Sutton's Drugstore from 1977 to 2014, says the rents have a major impact on the tenants. He says one former owner jacked my rent up from $800 a month to $3,000 a month and gave me 2 days notice, he says. Sutton's rent today, he says, is more than double that now. In spite of the challenges, many business owners remain excited about where downtown Chapel Hill is headed. Chapel Hill has been looking for its new identity for a while, Poitras says. Durham has found a great new identity the last dozen or so years. Downtown Raleigh, even Carrboro. We've probably been one of the last to find our new identity, although I think we're finding it now. Zapolsky agrees, citing a need for Chapel Hill to become more of a part of the Triangle experience. A major challenge for retail has been a lack of parking, which the town is scrambling to fix by implementing easier-to-use kiosks and opening up more spaces. Business owners have been meeting with the town council and mayor for years, asking for help, says Poitras. Now, he says, it's a renaissance time for downtown Chapel Hill. Mayor Heminger says Chapel Hill is trying to reduce the hurdles for businesses to come to Franklin Street and survive. Some of those incentives include a grant program for startups, as well as additional grants for downtown businesses to fix things like facades and lights. We've really pulled people together to figure out how to make it work, she says. While Zapolsky is optimistic about Chapel Hill's growth, he also believes there's much to be done. But that isn't easy in a college town with a two-century history and a main street that still evokes a small-town charm. It's hard to change a community that is reluctant to change, Zapolsky says. This week's executive voice belongs to Dr. David Zoss. Dr. David Zoss realized at an early age he wanted to be a doctor, even though no one in his immediate family was a physician. He earned degrees at Yale and Northwestern universities and was moving up the ranks as a doctor with a specialty in the difficult and rewarding field of lung transplants. But two major events altered his career. First, he earned an MBA from Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Fueled by that experience, he became CEO of Duke Raleigh Hospital. Then came a thunderbolt. On February 14, 2017, he learned he had acute myeloid leukemia, and he transitioned from caregiver to care receiver. Zoss is now back in the halls of Duke Raleigh with a new sense of purpose and compassion. So here's the Q&A with Zoss. You started your medical career heavily involved in lung transplants. What drew you to this? I first developed an interest in lung transplantation when I was an internal medicine resident at Johns Hopkins. The science and immunology of lung transplantation was fascinating to me, and it was advancing so rapidly. Clinically, I really enjoyed the ability to care for patients across the continuum of their disease. More importantly, I really loved the relationships I was able to develop with patients and their families in such a critical time of their lives. So why did you decide to get an MBA? I realized that my passion was to improve the ways we could deliver care to patients. I wanted to learn how to better improve our systems of care delivery. But in order to do that, I would need to understand the business of medicine to acquire the skills needed to help lead change. I not only learned the basics of finance, accounting, and strategy, but most importantly learned to work in teams to help solve problems. What book made an impact on you? I really enjoyed reading biographies about influential leaders throughout history. One of the most impactful books that I read in the last few years was Team of Rival by Doris Kearns Goodwin. I would encourage every young leader to read this book and more fully understand the greatness of Abraham Lincoln. She does a wonderful job of highlighting his unique ability as a leader to bring teams of people together. So what do you do to enjoy outside of your role at Duke? I love spending time with my family, especially our time traveling together. We have two boys, ages 12 and 14, who love soccer. So we frequently travel together on weekends throughout the southeastern United States to watch them play soccer, and have traveled internationally each of the last few summers to watch them play. What in your office is particularly meaningful? I have one wall that, instead of diplomas, is focused solely on my family. This wall includes a variety of photos and poems written by our children during elementary school. We all spend a lot of time at work away from our families, and this wall is an effective and constant reminder of what is absolutely the most important thing in my life. I also want all of my team members to know that my family is important, so they will see my family every time they meet in my office. How often do you go on rounds? I still try to do rounds every day with either patients or employees. It's really important to have that visibility and to make connections with our patients, their loved ones, and our team. It's true that I learn something new every time, and I want everyone in this hospital to feel comfortable talking with me and sharing their ideas and concerns. You found out you had acute myeloid leukemia on February the 14th of 2017. What was that day like? Like many physicians, I thought I was invincible and that I would never get sick. I was not feeling well for a few weeks, and I knew something was wrong. When we saw the abnormal lab results on Duke MyChart, Amy and I knew it was going to be a diagnosis of leukemia. I remember not being able to concentrate when they gave me the diagnosis the next day in clinic. My mind was focused on my kids and worried they would grow up without a father. Saying goodnight to them and trying to hold it together the evening after the diagnosis was one of the hardest things I've ever done. So how did your 13-year-old son become your bone marrow donor? We're grateful that we had a lot of family and friends get tested during this process to join the National Bone Marrow Registry. I was really fortunate that they identified my son Jake as a half match and a perfect bone marrow donor for me. They would use his immune system to not only replace mine, but also to attack any residual leukemia that existed in my body after the chemotherapy. Jake was so strong throughout the process and never even hesitated. It allowed my son to help me in a way that I never imagined, and I will never be able to repay. He occasionally likes to remind me that he saved my life when he's acting particularly like a teenager, but it's true. So how did the Duke Raleigh employees support you? We received an incredible and humbling outpouring of support. They sent cards, emails, and gifts, and left supportive and motivating comments regularly on our Caring Bridge blog. They organized a bone marrow drive for employees in the community. And when I started to lose my hair from a round of chemotherapy, they organized a head shaving challenge. More than 20 employees shaved their heads in front of the rest of the hospital and raised more than $20,000 for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. The mark of a good leader is when an organization can still run smoothly without him or her, and I'm proud of how everyone in the hospital, especially the rest of the executive leadership team, stepped up in my absence. So how's your health now? I battled with some pretty bad graft versus host disease after coming back to work in the fall, but it's mostly cleared up and I've returned to feeling 100%. I like to tell people all my energy is a result of that 14-year-old bone marrow. So how's being sick impacted how you view your career? I always thought I would approach illness differently as a physician, but throughout this, I haven't wanted to be the doctor. I didn't, and still haven't, read the literature about AML. I relied a lot on my wife and my care team to figure out the best course of action for me, and realize now how important it is for a patient to have an advocate when their mind is on other things. I also noticed how much you can tell who has real compassion. It's more than what you say. It's how you say it. We have the privilege of caring for patients and their families, and I think we owe it to them to make that connection, to develop that relationship, and to open ourselves up. That's what patients need. This week's Triangle Business Journal has an article entitled Being Open to Other Ideas Builds Trust, and it's written by Edward Marshall, who is an adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University, and the author of Building Trust at the Speed of Change. At a recent gathering of an Asian-African employee group at a global corporation, we discussed what constitutes diversity. An Indian woman suggested that perceptions were an important element of what makes us different. As we explored this distinction, it became clear that our perceptions, or how we view the world and others in it, are determined by how we were raised, our cultural heritage, and personal history, as well as events we've experienced. These factors shape our values and beliefs, and how we react to others. Our perceptions become our reality, or Huxley's door to the known. But at work, what can get us into trouble is when we cling to our own views and ignore the unknown door of perception. It's only when we walk through that door that we discover the full truth about a situation. Where this becomes critical is when a leadership team is making a strategic decision. A majority of the team shares one view, and the minority have very different perceptions. If the majority speed bumps the minority, they run the risk of making the wrong decision. We are stronger when we fully engage our differences. Not unlike EQ, or emotional intelligence, here are some steps each one of us can take to increase our PQ, that is, our perception quotient. So be humble. If we start from a place of humility and vulnerability that we don't have all the answers, we create the context for a dialogue based on mutual understanding and respect. Stop and reflect. When our view about a person or situation hardens and we are humble, we can stop and reflect. We can check our own assumptions before drawing conclusions. Inquire and explore. Now the unknown perception door is open, and we can seek to understand the perceptions and realities of others and explore their points of view. And finally, co-create. Together, you can create a shared truth and a new solution. By opening the door of the unknown perceptions, by being humble and self-reflective, we will create a new reality. But more importantly, we will build trust and mutual respect in our diverse relationships. Now, this week's Viewpoint page has a guest article by Cindy Barth, who happens to be editor of the Orlando Business Journal. The article is entitled, "In a Corporate World, Words Mean a Lot." From time to time, most of us get around to talking about the importance of ethics. In journalism, ethics is everything, especially in light of an environment right now that quickly moves to accusations of fake news when someone doesn't agree with what you wrote or believes you're biased in the reporting of the news. But just as ethics is important when it comes to how we report the news, it's equally important in how you run your business, build your company, and interact with others in the local community. With that in mind, market research company Morning Consult polled Americans to ask which companies they consider most ethical, as well as a number of other interesting tidbits that I'd like to share with you. The poll asked 6,600 people to think of a company that is ethical and name the first one that came to mind. Then it ranked them based on mentions. However, that question was part of a larger report looking at what people want from brands when it comes to key ethical and political matters. It turns out that Walmart Incorporated tops the list of corporations that American consumers think are most ethical, according to Morning Consult. Interestingly enough, the top 10 companies on the list are all large retailers, restaurants, or tech companies. Here are some of the poll's findings. Walmart led with 699 mentions, followed by fellow retailers Amazon with 450, and Target, 301. Costco received 109 mentions. Restaurants Chick-fil-A, 239, Starbucks, 165, and McDonald's, 69, also cracked the top 10, along with tech giants Apple, 137, Google, 83, and Microsoft with 82 mentions. What should be a little more revealing to you, especially if you're a business owner or company leader, is that 45% of those surveyed said they feel corporations are becoming less ethical. Just 25% think they're becoming more ethical. Ouch. But the stat that caught my eye is this one. 60% of us would prefer that brands stay out of politics, while 66% think corporations already have more political influence than they should. And in case you wondered, those surveyed also want corporations to avoid weighing in on abortion, kneeling during a national anthem, and immigration, while commenting on civil rights, criminal justice reform, and LGBTQ rights is acceptable. So what does that mean to you and your business? The survey findings highlight the fact that companies large and small are being watched more closely than ever before. And the most likely factor driving that scrutiny is a nationwide atmosphere in which civility often takes a backseat to rudeness, while ethics take a backseat to whatever is most convenient at the time. The bottom line? People are paying more attention than ever to what you do and say. Make sure the message they're getting really is the one you intended. And this week's editor's notebook is entitled, "What May Have Happened to the Giant Apple Project?" In a period of some 3 months, North Carolina media, including us, must have written at least 36 stories on Apple's apparent interest in North Carolina. It started with Triangle Business Journal breaking the news about the project in May, and how Governor Roy Cooper met with Apple CEO Tim Cook when Cook was speaking to newly minted Duke University graduates. Thanks to our sources, we had a pretty good idea of where the project was heading and the frantic discussions taking place between North Carolina officials and folks from Cupertino, California. That went on for a month, and government sources at that time indicated that Apple was wary of North Carolina lawmakers sneaking in some language in some bill that could prove troublesome for the Apple management board and its institutional investors. So the company wanted the lawmakers gone before finalizing the paperwork. Well, the lawmakers left late June, so why is this radio silence? When a big economic development project is in the news, and state lawmakers tweak the law to accommodate the company, and work on the temporary space gets underway, conventional wisdom is parties are simply crossing the T's and dotting the I's before an announcement. Our sources maintain that the project is a go, and what Apple and North Carolina currently are talking about are some complex timeline issues regarding its campus and research Triangle Park. That may include things such as covenants that require the California giant to get started on the campus sooner rather than later. Apple may be thinking of a 5-year timeline, but North Carolina officials are thinking a 3-year window. There's also been talk among more than a few real estate professionals that Apple may require more than one facility to start its North Carolina operations. It already has been reported that the company had initially selected a facility in Cary as a temporary location. Now we hear a second facility in Raleigh is a possibility as well. But why is a company balking at making a public announcement? Surely North Carolina would rather have Apple come out and make a big public splash. I think the parties are hung up on the language relating to incentives, the timeline, and the land acquisition process. I think the overall plan is still in place. In recent weeks, an Apple manager from Austin, Texas, even mentioned to me that one of his colleagues from Austin was in Cary to go over the layout of the temporary space left vacant by Fidelity Investments. But one thing is for sure, the longer this lingers, the more difficult it will be for the parties to strike a deal. Just ask anyone who's been in the middle of a merger or an acquisition. When things get quiet or it feels that it's slowed down, new problems mysteriously appear. We can't let that happen with this project. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.